Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. P. Kelly.
Hi, everyone. It's April 17th, 2020, and we are just over 1 month into the COVID-19 global pandemic. I want to welcome Dr. Martin Antony to the podcast to talk about the management of health anxiety during this very challenging time. Dr. Antony is a professor in the Department of Psychology at Ryerson University, provincial clinical lead for MindAbility, previously the Ontario Structured Psychotherapy Program, and president of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. Previously, he was founding director of both the Anxiety Treatment and Research Clinic and the Psychology Residency Program at St. Joseph's Healthcare, Hamilton. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and previously served as president of the Canadian Psychological Association. He has published over 30 books and over 250 scientific articles and chapters in areas related to cognitive behavior therapy and anxiety-related disorders. He has given more than 425 presentations to audiences across four continents and has been interviewed, featured, and quoted more than 450 times in various print, radio, television, and online media outlets, including CBC, CNN, The Globe and Mail, National Post, Toronto Star, New York Times, Washington Post, and Scientific American Mind, and many others. Dr. Antony, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Excellent. So I guess we'll start off by asking sort of a fairly basic question, but one which I think will help orient the listener. Can you briefly outline what is health anxiety from a clinical perspective?
So the way I think about health anxiety, well, the first thing I'll mention is there is no sort of official definition of the term health anxiety, but I can share with you how I think about it. So it's probably easiest to think about the two words separately first. So when we think about anxiety, we're really thinking about some future-oriented threat. And anxiety is actually different than fear. They often go hand in hand, but they're different. So fear is an emotional response to some immediate threat. It's that fight or flight response that people get when a bear is chasing them or when they're about to get into a car accident or something like that. Anxiety is more future oriented. So it's the feeling we get when we have an exam coming up or we're getting married next week. Or in the case of health anxiety, we're worried about some health problem that we may or may not have. Health anxiety is basically just anxiety focused on health and disease and those kinds of themes. It occurs across a wide range of problems. The first thing I'll mention is we all experience some health anxiety from time to time. So all of us have had some kind of symptom that worried us that led us to go visit a doctor, for example. Health anxiety can also be a feature of lots of different psychological problems that people experience. So people with generalized anxiety disorder who worry excessively about a lot of different things may worry about their health as part of that. People who have what we call panic disorder, where people have panic attacks, rushes of fear out of the blue with a lot of physical symptoms may experience anxiety about their health in the context of those attacks. It may feel like they're about to faint or that they're having a heart attack or a stroke or something like that. In obsessive compulsive disorder, some people may have health anxiety, some particular people who worry about contamination and may be afraid that they're going to get some sort of disease through contamination. They may have to wash their hands again and again, may experience anxiety over health in that context. There are other problems. There's a problem called illness anxiety disorder, where people are convinced that they have some physical, serious physical illness like cancer or something like that. Even though they don't have any symptoms, they still feel strongly that they may have something and they may go to doctors frequently to get those symptoms checked out. And then lastly, there are also people who just have lots of uncomfortable symptoms that are bothersome to them. They may experience a lot of pain, for example, dizziness or other symptoms that lead them to go to physicians frequently to check things out. And they may worry about those symptoms. So it occurs across a wide range of problems and again, can occur in people who don't have any of these problems. People with health anxiety may be afraid that they're going to get sick, or they may be afraid that they already are sick and need to get checked out or get tested or get treatment. And then lastly, people can be anxious about the health of others. So parents may be anxious about their children's health, or people may be anxious about their parents' health or their partner's health. So it can extend to others as well, potentially. So that's how I think about health anxiety. It's a very broad kind of phenomenon that manifests in all these different ways.
Knowing that it is a very broad phenomenon, is there some way of generically conceptualizing health anxiety from a cognitive behavioral perspective?
Yeah, so broadly, cognitive behavioral perspective is basically just the idea that it's our thoughts and behaviors that determine how we feel. So whether we, you know, if we feel a racing heart, for example, depending on how we interpret that racing heart, we're going to have different emotional experiences. So, for example, if somebody has just slighted us in some way and we're angry at that person, our heart may race, and we're just going to interpret our racing heart in that kind of angry kind of context. On the other hand, if we are just sitting there watching TV and we're kind of afraid of a racing heart and our heart starts to race a little bit, we might interpret that as dangerous in some way, and that might lead our heart to race even more and may culminate in a panic attack. When we're on a roller coaster, that racing heart is interpreted as excitement, and you know, we make it more of a thrill or a happy, excited kind of feeling on the roller coaster. So depending on how we interpret those feelings, we can experience different kinds of emotions. So so from a cognitive perspective, it's people's beliefs about the symptoms they experience. If they see a spot on their skin and they think it's a birthmark, then there's no emotion tied to that. If, on the other hand, they think it's cancer, then there might be fear associated with that. Our thoughts about symptoms. If we're predicting that we're going to get sick, that's going to affect our emotions as well. We're going to feel more anxiety and so on. The other piece of the cognitive behavioral model is people's behaviors. So what we do when we experience different emotions determines what happens afterwards. So, for example, many of us, when we experience anxiety and fear, we do things to reduce that anxiety. So we may avoid situations that trigger anxiety. We may over-prepare for situations that we are worried might be threatening, that we worry may be threatening. We may also engage in safety behaviors. We may distract ourselves from things that make us anxious. And those behaviors in the short term are often effective for reducing anxiety, but they may help to keep our anxiety alive over the long term. So we want to understand the role of those kinds of behaviors in addition to the role of people's thinking in order to understand their anxiety. We also want to be aware of what kinds of triggers people experience. So the thoughts and behaviors are not random. They usually occur in response to some sort of trigger, something that happens in our environment or something that happens internally, like a racing heart, for example. And we also want to keep in mind the interaction with biological factors that we have no control over. So some of us may just get uncomfortable symptoms, like dizziness, for example, for who knows why we got up too quickly, for example, or we haven't had enough to eat or something like that. And that may trigger some of these sensations that then trigger some of these thoughts and behaviors. So the experience is really an interaction of what we're thinking, what's going on biologically, triggers in any given moment, and how we respond to those triggers, our behaviors.
With the aim of perhaps helping people build awareness of what they may be experiencing, what are some of the common specific worries and behaviors that clients with health anxiety might be likely to be experiencing right now?
So right now, in light of COVID-19, I guess one thing I would say is that the usual worries that people have are probably still there as well. So right. People are likely worrying about cancer and having MS and, you know, those sorts of things. But in addition to that, there's this added worry of COVID-related symptoms. So for example, some people are reporting, for example, that the stress that they're under right now, financial stress or The stress of having to work at home and their partner's also working at home and they have two kids doing school at home. They only have one computer that they're all sharing and people are beginning to get on one another's nerves and all that kind of stuff. The stress of that, some people may worry is going to impact on their immune system, which is going to make them more likely to get COVID-19, for example. So people may worry not just about just randomly getting COVID-19, but that the whole situation may increase their likelihood, or the fact that generally they're anxious is going to make them more susceptible, possibly. People may also, a lot of people with health anxiety will commonly check things out with their doctor, or go to the emergency room, and that's something they can't do as easily now.
Right.
They may be afraid to go to the emergency room or afraid to go to their doctor's office, and we're certainly being discouraged from doing that under normal circumstances. So that may be challenging for people as well, creating extra anxiety because they can't get that reassurance that they want so much. And also health anxiety may be leading to relationship challenges. So, you know, couples can often experience stress when they disagree about things. And we know that money, for example, is something that couples disagree on. But right now, I suspect that couples are disagreeing about the best way to handle COVID. We know that some people are more careful, for example, than others. Some people are following the guidelines to the T, other people are not. Some people are following the guidelines to the T, other people are going way beyond those guidelines in order to protect themselves. And if one person has a lot of health anxiety and the other person doesn't, there may be disagreements, not just about how the individual should handle their own health, but also someone with a lot of health anxiety may put a lot of demands on somebody else to be responding in a certain way as well, because essentially any risk to anyone in the families creates a risk for everybody. So I suspect there's also relationship sort of challenges that are coming up as a result of this as well.
This is maybe more of a question for the clinicians out there. How would we differentiate between maybe some of the safety behaviors that go along with health anxiety versus compulsions that we might see in like a contamination-based OCD?
So one thing I guess I would think about is that what was a compulsion 2 months ago may just be a normal, helpful behavior now.
Right.
So things are different now. So a couple of months ago, there really wasn't a need to be washing your hands. You know, we're supposed to wash your hands, but not maybe as often as you are now. A couple of months ago, letting your mail sit there for 3 days before you open it, or opening your pizza box with gloves, or going to the supermarket with a mask, those might have been seen as OCD-like behaviors.
Right.
And, you know, now some of those things a lot of people are doing, some of those things people may not be doing, but they're all seen within the normal range now and a potentially healthy range. So I think we need to take the behavior in the context in which it's happening. And one thing that I like to ask is, are the behaviors different than the behaviors that are being recommended? Are they different? Are they outside of the range of what people are doing? So for example, letting your mail sit for a few days because we know that COVID can be on surfaces for a couple of days or something. You know, not everybody is doing that, but some people are. It's not, it's within the realm of what the responses that we're seeing. Recognizing that in some ways it's, for some people, this is going to be a time to put their OCD treatment on hold even, you know, because a lot of the things that we would want them to do in terms of going out there and touching things that are contaminated and things like that, this is just not the time to be doing that. So this isn't going to go on forever, you know, within, you know, I guess there's estimates from, depending on who you listen to, some people are saying in 2 weeks we're going to be back at work. Other people are saying in 2 years we're going to things will be back to normal. So, but regardless, it is going to return to normal at some point. And the way we handle these kinds of symptoms or behaviors right now may be different than what we will recommend again once this pandemic is behind us.
We know for stressful events in general that the more unpredictable, the more uncontrollable, the more chronic they are, the worse they tend to be with respect to outcomes for people. What do you think are some of the active ingredients in the current situation that are likely to be precipitating or aggravating health anxiety in vulnerable individuals?
Yeah, so you answered part of that question just before you asked the question. So I'll just reiterate some of the things that you suggested, because I think they're really important, and then mention some others. So
sure.
One is, you mentioned unpredictability, or another way of thinking about this, that is uncertainty. So the situation is uncertain, and we know that uncertainty and unpredictability contribute to anxiety. It's sort of this not knowing what's going to happen. And there's a number of aspects of this that are unpredictable and uncertain. One is the threat is invisible. So we don't know where the threat is. In some ways, it's like a monster or murderer or something hiding behind our furniture or something like that. We can't see it. We can't find it. We can't even test for it. Most of us have no access to testing for it. So so the threat is lurking, and it's uncertain where it is and whether we're going to get it. The other thing that we don't know is when it's going to go away. So again, the estimates have ranged from 2 weeks to 2 years, and that creates a lot of uncertainty around income, around when I'm going to be able to socialize and see my family again, and all these sorts of things that people are struggling with right now, which increases stress levels. And a lot of times when people's overall stress is higher, the little sort of areas that are their vulnerabilities become tougher as well. So if someone's prone to health anxiety under a lot of stress, that anxiety may be worse. If someone's prone to drinking too much under a lot of stress, they may drink a little bit more. So those vulnerabilities tend to get worse when we're under stress, and uncertainty contributes to that. Another active ingredient that contributes to this situation is the lack of control. So unpredictability refers to just not knowing what's going to happen. Uncontrollability refers to having no control over what happens. And this is a situation where we can have some control. We can follow the rules and engage in physical distancing and so on. But beyond taking some control over those situations, there's a lot of stuff we have no control over. We have no control over when this is going to go away, when we're going to be able to return back to work, when we'll be able to see our family, those kinds of things. And not having that control is hard for people. The constant media coverage, I think, is another active ingredient that contributes to stress for people. So we know that generally the media is a source of anxiety for people. So when there's constant coverage about terrorism and plane crashes and things like that, people become more afraid of flying. When there's constant coverage about pandemics, people become afraid of doing things that that could lead to infection. So, and it becomes something that they worry about, and something that makes it hard to sleep, and has all these sort of indirect effects as well. There may be reinforcement from others for certain kinds of anxiety behaviors that contribute to health anxiety for people as well. So, if other people are if you're getting lots of positive reinforcement from others for things that you're doing, that'll make you more likely to want to do those things. And it's fine if it's, again, just following Health Canada guidelines. But in some cases, people may be going way beyond that in terms of what they need to be doing. And then I'd say the other problem right now is the spread of misinformation. So there's lots of contradictory information out there about what we need to be doing. And again, ranging from, we should not touch, even people we live with, we shouldn't touch surfaces. And even if we haven't gone out, we need to be cleaning surfaces. And at the other extreme, this is way overblown and we should just ignore all these rules. So basically anybody who's sort of biased or leaning in a particular way, they can find somebody out there saying something that supports what they believe. So I think that's a challenge as well, as just the breadth of information, misinformation really that's out there.
Just to build on a couple of things you were mentioning there, the recommendation for the public, of course, is to be vigilant about COVID-19 symptoms, having a cough, fever, things like that, and to stay home if they have those symptoms. I wonder how this translates to both helpful and unhelpful body scanning, interceptive checks, related preoccupations, things like that. How can people who are affected by health anxiety moderate unhelpful behaviors yet remain good stewards of their health and the health of those that they love?
A lot of times when we're anxious, we do become more vigilant for potential threats. So somebody with a fear of spiders will often notice every spot on a wall, for example, it may jump out as if it's a spider. And similarly, people with health anxiety are very vigilant for physical sensations. So, you know, how do we distinguish between what's normal or healthy and adaptive versus reactions that may be excessive? Right now, it's a little bit hard. You know, when there's not a pandemic, it's much easier. But there's a few things that people can do. So one is to think about what physicians think about. So if I go to my physician with a headache, for example, before they treat the headache, they're going to look at a few things. They're going to look at the severity of the symptoms. They're going to look at how long the symptoms have lasted. If I've only had a headache for 20 minutes, they'll just send me home and say, come back if it's still going on in a couple of days.
Right.
And they'll also look at whether this is different. You know, is this headache qualitatively different from any headache that I've had in the past? And those are things to think about. So if somebody is prone to panic attacks, for example, and they're having some breathlessness and racing heart, and it's been going on for 30 minutes, like a lot of their panic attacks, we might not look at it in the same way as if this breathlessness has been going on for a few days. If the severity of it is similar to what they've experienced before with other panic attacks or other colds, for example, we might not worry about it at that point. The quality, the severity, and the duration would be three things to look at. A few other things to think about is to try to get a sense of how others are dealing with the situation, to know whether your reaction is excessive or not. Talk to people who you trust. Don't talk to people who are on the extremes in terms of their reactions, but talk to people who are kind of in the middle, people who you know who generally take a sort of balanced view toward these kinds of things. You can survey other people. You can also look at reputable websites. The CDC or the World Health Organization or Health Canada, those kinds of websites will have information that is sort of the best, based on the best scientific evidence that we have, versus just some person on a YouTube channel talking about what they think we should all be doing.
Message boards are my most feared source of information when clients come in.
Exactly.
Yeah, those message boards can be quite problematic for a number of reasons. Yeah. Many of our clients with health anxiety are quite vulnerable to excessive reassurance seeking, internet research, excessive news consumption, things like we've mentioned before. However, there are a subset of health anxiety clients who are quite avoidant. What suggestions might you have for clients who struggle in this particular way?
Yeah, so we often talk about these two types of responses as monitoring and blunting. So monitoring is a tendency to seek out threat-related information. So when you're nervous about something, you spend hours online looking it up and you ask people for information and you go out seeking information to tell you whether you're in danger or not. Blunting is the opposite. Blunting is where you avoid threat-related information. And the idea here is that, you know, what I don't know won't hurt me. So you avoid all. You don't want to talk about the issue. You definitely don't go online. And both can be problematic. Both can help reinforce anxiety. And really what we want people to do is to find sort of a balance point in the middle somewhere. So if somebody is avoiding all information on COVID, we might encourage them to seek out a little bit of information, again, from reputable sources, limit it to a certain amount each day so that they're not, you know, spending hours and hours doing this and letting the anxiety happen. So, we'll talk about strategies for managing the anxiety in a bit, but not fighting those feelings. You know, the more people try to control their anxiety, the more it sticks around and sometimes the more it gets worse.
What kinds of behaviors or coping strategies will be most helpful for clients with health anxiety at this time? What kind of behaviors would you consider to be unhelpful?
So in terms of behaviors that would be helpful, I think one is just generally managing stress levels. So problem solving, for example, a lot of us, when we're under stress, we'll get overwhelmed with problems that we face. If people are dealing with financial stresses or again, stresses of just having everybody in the house, those kinds of things, rather than just being overwhelmed with those situations, is just to try to figure out ways of solving some of those day-to-day problems. So identifying what the problem is, brainstorming possible solutions, evaluating the different solutions you've come up with, implementing those solutions, and evaluating the evaluating the outcome of implementing those solutions. Relaxation-based strategies, teaching people, we encourage people to slow down their breathing, for example. Progressive muscle relaxation involves tensing and relaxing different muscle groups. Mindfulness-based strategies, meditation, for example. All of these can be useful for stress management. And mindfulness can also be a useful strategy for anxiety as well, especially for people who have a lot of difficulty letting the anxiety happen, who feel like they need to control the anxiety or distract themselves from it or make it go away. Sitting with it, being aware of it, not trying to control it is one of the best ways to handle it in the moment rather than doing something about it. If people are finding that they're engaging in unrealistic or kind of biased thinking about this, so they're, you know, having thoughts about things never getting better or being convinced that they have COVID, even though there's no evidence that they do. In those situations, we encourage people to really try to be aware of these thoughts that are contributing to their anxiety and evaluating whether those thoughts are realistic, looking at the evidence for their thoughts, looking at evidence against their thoughts, trying to think flexibly about situations. A lot of times when we're anxious or depressed, we kind of focus in on a particular interpretation, and it's hard for us to see any other way of looking at things. We almost need to force ourselves to do this. And you might ask yourself, how might somebody who's not anxious be thinking about this differently than me? And can I get into that person's head for a moment? And so that can be useful. I also think it's really useful. You know, sometimes people may have the thought, well, this must be dangerous because they, you know, we're willing to put the whole economy at risk. We're basically, this is a pretty intense kind of intervention. It must mean that we're all in danger.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that. And what I encourage people to do is to distinguish between a personal threat and a public health threat. There are lots of other examples of situations where we engage in kind of extreme behavior because something is a public health threat. A good example is airport screening. It's extremely expensive. It's really inconvenient for those of us who travel a lot. It's a pain. It takes up a lot of time. And the risk of any one of us being a victim of a terrorist attack is very, very low. However, if there's no screening, the risk of more terrorist attacks happening is probably high. So another example is recycling. You know, if I don't recycle, who cares? If nobody recycles, we're going to have a problem. Or if everybody litters, there's going to be a problem. If I'm the only one littering, it's probably not a problem. Vaccinations, another example. If my kids don't get vaccinated, they're probably going to be fine. If no kids get vaccinated, then there's going to be a big problem. We'll see proliferation of polio and all these measles, all these other problems that mostly were under control. And it's the same with this, that right now, anyway, I mean, this could change, but right now, it's still, if you look at the number of people in Canada and in the US and the world who are getting this, it's still fairly low. If we follow these guidelines, the idea is that we'll be able to keep it lower. If we don't, it doesn't mean that when I go out, I'm probably going to get COVID-19 and I'm probably going to die. The reality is right now, if I go out, I'm probably not going to get it. But if we all go out, more people are going to get it. It's also the reality is if even if I do get it, most people who get it live. What I'm hearing data out of Iceland, 50% of people don't even get symptoms, but 20% right. of people get really, really sick. So, you know, if we just think about it probabilistically, that the threat to any one of us as an individual is probably low, but the public health threat is very high. And I think that may help people to feel a little bit safer as individuals, while still reinforcing the message that we need to be following all the guidelines to prevent it from becoming much bigger problem than it is right now. That's how I think about it anyway. And I'm saying that with the caveat that I'm not a public health expert.
Of course.
But how I'm, what I'm, what I'm sort of seeing from the experts. That's how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, well, I think we can use the available data to inform the lens that we bring to bear upon these kind of problems.
Exactly. Yeah, and we hear the phrase, it's maybe a bit of a cliche, that we're all in this together, and that's sort of a similar kind of message, that it's we're really doing this to protect our world, to protect our country, not necessarily just to protect us as individuals. So I think those are a couple of other just quick things for people to remember, is to stay active, stay engaged. When people become inactive and aren't doing anything, it gives them more time to think about what makes them anxious. And avoiding, if people are watching too much COVID-19 related media, try to decrease that as well.
Many individuals with health anxiety can be quite anxious and often have an urge to frequently seek reassurance from their mental health professional. Do you have any advice for how people with health anxiety can effectively think through how and when to consult their mental health provider?
Yeah, so I guess similar kinds of issues to think about when we're thinking about whether to seek medical assistance. So with any kind of change, anxiety is a normal kind of reaction, but people usually adapt over time. So the first thing I might think about is the duration of the anxiety. So if people are experiencing anxiety, but it's still a fairly new situation, I might suggest giving it a few weeks and seeing what happens. So I would also look at whether my reaction is different from others. So one good way of dealing with stress generally that I haven't mentioned is through social support. So making sure that we were seeking out those supports that without getting too physically close to people. It can be helpful to just find out, how are other people dealing with this? And one of the things I'm learning just from talking to other healthcare professionals is most of them are experiencing very similar things that I'm experiencing. So that that can be reassuring as well. If what you're experiencing is kind of what your friends and colleagues are experiencing, that can be useful. Right. And then the severity, if the severity is really unmanageable, it's going on for a long time, and it's different from what other people are experiencing, those would be the three things I would look for in making that decision whether to seek help.
No, I think that's really helpful. A question for, I think on behalf of clinicians, for health and mental health professionals that are providing services to clients with health anxiety, how can we best help clients who are highly distressed, but while not setting their treatment back through accommodating safety behaviors, things of that nature?
So I guess every client's going to be different. So it's hard to give very specific kind of feedback that would apply in every case. But generally, what I would be trying to do is to try to balance those two things. So if the kinds of behaviors somebody is engaging in are within the range that we are seeing for a lot of people with in this COVID-19 situation, then even though they may, from a therapeutic perspective, may not be particularly helpful, it may be sort of an uphill battle to try to change those kinds of behaviors, at this time. And again, as therapists, giving clients some slack around that, but also clients encouraging them to give themselves a bit of slack right now. There'll be lots of time to use the therapy the way it's meant to be used, and this may not be that time. On the other hand, if some of these behaviors are way out of proportion to what we're seeing right now, or if there are ways of intervening that don't go against what the health recommendations are, then that might be things to try out. Keep in mind that COVID-19 right now is just causing this elevated stress level for many of us right now. And asking people to add the stress of exposure therapy, for example, or some of the other strategies that we use that in themselves are stressful, this may not be the time to do it necessarily. So I would also be thinking about how urgent is it for this individual to deal with this right now. If they're kind of ambivalent about it and it's not that urgent, that may be a reason to wait. On the other hand, if the client's really on board or if it is more urgent for whatever reason, then that might be a time to go ahead with it despite this added stress level. And in the end, I'd say when a when there's a conflict between what's best for health anxiety based on our guidelines for treating health anxiety and what's best for preventing the pandemic from spreading, because sometimes there's a tension there, a conflict there. Right now, I'm encouraging people to prioritize what's best for the pandemic.
Those are all great points. And I really appreciate your point about pacing therapy and matching it to the demands of the environment currently. I think an honest reflection by any human right now is that, I mean, at least for myself, life in general just feels like it's 25% harder than it needs to be at every turn. So yeah. I can certainly imagine trying to undertake therapy or augment therapy at a time like this may not be ideal or feasible or even possible.
Yeah. So it may take longer to do therapy. It may not work quite as well. And for some people, I'm hearing that some people are just putting their therapy on hold for now. We'll come back to it in a few months or something. Other people are continuing to work at it. Some people are still very engaged and very motivated. So everybody's sort of responding to this differently.
Absolutely. One last question for you. Are there any online resources that you would recommend to people?
There are so many. So it seems like everybody is putting stuff out there. And there are a few sites that I'll mention that have sort of put together a list of resources that you can go to. So in Canada, the Canadian Association for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapy, CACBT, has some great resources on their website. So if you go to cacbt.ca, the Canadian Psychological Association, CPA, if you go to cpa.ca, they have a link on their website to, again, a page of coronavirus resources. Anxiety Canada, which is a Canada-wide anxiety disorders association. If you go to anxietycanada.com, they have a link to resources on their site. There are similar sites in the U.S., so the American Psychological Association, APA.org, the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, ADAA.org, and the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, ABCT.org. All of those have information on their sites as well. And then there are also just good resources that individual therapists and psychologists and other professionals have put together. One that I like, for example, is it's a 40-page document. They're updating it regularly, and it's by an anxiety expert at Hofstra University that includes a wide range of tips, basically, for dealing with anxiety and depression related to COVID-19. And the website for that is Psych Rescue, PsychRescue, hyphen, okay, not underscore, but hyphen, COVID-19, COVID-19.com. You can get that information there. So those are just a few places off the top of my head that people may want to look at.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it. I know any time that you've spent here with me today is time away from your clients, your colleagues, your supervisees, your family. So I really, really appreciate it. I'm sure folks who have health anxiety or are curious about health anxiety are going to get a lot out of this conversation. So I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for the invitation.
No problem. We'll talk soon. Thanks so much. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Bye. Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.